Welcome to the Arlington Street Church podcast. Founded in 1729, Arlington Street continues today as a gathering place for progressive people of faith in the greater Boston area and beyond. We are located at the corner of Arlington and Boylston Streets, across from the Public Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. Please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.
Our reading is excerpts from the book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together by Heather McGee. The American landscape was once graced with resplendent swimming pools, some big enough to hold thousands of swimmers at a time. In the 1920s, towns and cities tried to outdo one another by building the most elaborate pools. In the 1930s, the Works Progress Administration put people to work building hundreds more. By World War II, the country's 2,000 pools were glittering symbols of a new commitment by local officials to the quality of life for their residents, allowing tens of thousands of people to socialize together for free. By the 1950s, the fight to integrate America's prized public swimming pools would demonstrate the limits of white commitment to public goods. In Montgomery, Alabama, the Oak Park Pool was the grandest one for miles, the crown jewel of the Parks Department that also included a zoo, a community center, and a dozen other public parks. Dorothy Moore was a white teenage lifeguard when a federal court deemed the town's segregated recreation unconstitutional. Suddenly, black children would be able to wade into the deep end with white children at the Oak Park Pool. At the rec center, black elders would get chairs at the card table. The reaction of the city council was swift. Effective January 1st, 1959, the Parks Department would be no more. The council decided to drain the pool rather than share it with their black neighbors. Of course, the decision meant that white families lost a public resource as well. It was miserable, Mrs. Moore told a reporter 5 decades later. Uncomprehending white children cried as the city contractors poured dirt in the pool, paved it over, and seeded it with grass that was green by the time summer came along again. To defy desegregation, Montgomery would go on to close every single public park and padlock the doors of the community center. It even sold off the animals in the zoo. The entire public park system would stay closed for over a decade. Even after it reopened, they never rebuilt the pool. Today, we don't even notice the absence of the grand pools in our communities. Where grass grows over former sites, there are no plaques to tell the story of how racism drained the pool. But the spirit that drained these public goods lives on. The impulse now manifests itself in subtler fashion, more often in a pool of public resources than a literal one. So ends the reading. So good morning again. It is good to be back for the first time in quite a number of times to Arlington Street. I want to thank my very dear and longtime colleague, the Reverend Parisa Parsa, for inviting me back, to Michael for the music, and Patrick for coordinating this morning's service, and for all those who are helping pull it together. My colleague Maggie Paula is here somewhere, I think, and she will be in the social hour with me in case you have questions about the work of the Urban Ministry after today's service. So Arlington Street is one of 46 member congregations around Greater Boston that are connected to the work of the Unitarian Universalist Urban Ministry as members. And the Urban Ministry was founded 200 years ago by a Unitarian minister who is striving for social justice in Boston with the combined power of Unitarian congregations. And the congregations like Arlington Street continue to play an important role in our work to dismantle racism and to advance racial, social, and economic justice. So today, in 2025, the Urban Ministry has a youth program that serves high school students of color from Boston. We have a domestic violence shelter that serves families rebuilding their lives. And we partner with Roxbury businesses and nonprofits, bringing congregations and the Roxbury community together for change. It's a pleasure to visit congregations that are our members to thank those among you who support our work and make it possible. I'd like to give a special shout out to longtime supporters Gaby and Reverend George Whitehouse. Reverend Whitehouse served for many years on the board of the Urban Ministry and is, as you know, a stalwart champion for justice. And I also want to lift up our good friends like John and Wendy Ellertson, who love this congregation, and they are pillars of the Roxbury neighborhood where we stand and great friends of ours. And I want to thank supporters that include John and Dorothy Batiste, Sarah and Patrick Kulibeck, Alma Antonietti, Gail Genes. And thank all of you for supporting our Renewal House domestic violence shelter for 30 years. You have faithfully given, so thank you. It's good to be here to appreciate you. So this morning, I wanted to share a trip that I took in September to the Canadian Rockies. As I was reflecting on 10 years serving at the Urban Ministry, this fall marked my decade of service. Has anybody been to the Canadian Rockies? Anybody here? Yeah, a few. So you know that it's a stunning landscape. And so I hiked in this beautiful place as I looked back at what I've learned in this work while I climbed up a steep elevation, adjusting an awkward backpack, taking in views of glaciers and azure blue water. It wasn't easy going up. I bruised my toes coming down, but it was a wondrous trip. I thought of how it is like the work for justice, bit by bit, sometimes hard and uncomfortable, and with unexpected gifts along the way. I looked back at arriving in Roxbury in November of 2014, when it became clear that the work before us was more than our programs. There was a core question beneath. How would we address racism in Greater Boston? We're an historically white-led organization in the heart of Boston's historic African-American community. And we're encircled by suburban, a few urban, mostly white congregations who are reaching out to us to help make change. I was gripped by the challenge and the potential and how much I had to learn to get my arms around it. But before I could do that, before I could get my arms around it, I was called on to preach in pulpits like this, and I brought no expertise that first season, no profound message. I brought my questions. What did it mean to be a white-led organization in Roxbury? How do we forge real relationships across difference? How do we make change that really matters? And I began simply listening, learning, and following. In these 10 years, the police officers who killed Michael Brown were not indicted, sparking the Black Lives Matter movement. we witnessed the election of 2016 and the killing of George Floyd. White people were shaken out of a collective slumber. We learned that the waters of racism in the United States go deep. And the more that I've learned, the deeper those waters go. I first learned about health, wealth, and educational disparities that mean Black people live poorer and die sooner than white people. There is a 23-year difference in life expectancy in Roxbury and Whiteback Bay, just 1 mile away. And the waters went deeper still. I learned about the racism baked into the systems that create those statistics, the prison, healthcare, and food systems. African Americans are incarcerated at 5 times the rate of white people. Only half of African Americans have private health insurance versus 75% of white people, and 22% of Black people in the United States experience food insecurity, twice the rate of white people, and I have no doubt that that number is going to increase in the weeks and months ahead. And the deep waters grew colder. I learned how these systems are rooted in enslavement, how the police system grew out of slave patrols, how founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson were themselves enslavers whose economic well-being was secured through bondage, how after the Civil War, the prison system replaced enslavement as Blacks were charged with petty crimes and sentenced to hard labor, sometimes in the very same fields where plantations once stood. I learned we cannot disentangle modern educational, housing, and economic systems from this history. Racism isn't a fistful of solvable problems, it is foundational. And to move forward in any meaningful way in our nation's and our region's social ailments, we must face it together. I packed a book on my trip to the Rockies. It was the book that I read from earlier, The Sum of Us, by researcher Heather McGee. She began her research after the 2016 election when many of us were asking, why didn't people vote in their own self-interest? Do people remember asking that question? Why do people not vote in their own self-interest? Asking it now as well. She looked at the racism that showed itself in the election and in our nation's political turmoil. Her thesis is this: our country's ongoing struggle for meaningful healthcare reform, positive economic change, even investment in infrastructure like roadways, our struggle to achieve collective good despite our abundant wealth and resources can be traced to enslavement. White people, McGee writes, have been conditioned to believe in a zero-sum equation. If people of color gain, they lose. And the stronger a person's racial resentment, the likelier to reject policies and investments that benefit all of us, including themselves. McGee asserts that etched deeply into the white psyche is a value placed on whiteness. And when whites see Black people in the swimming pool, they'd rather not have a pool than to be in it with them and erase the status conferred by whiteness. And it is this deep-seated disfigurement of the white psyche that billionaire titans and political tacticians lean into with racist dog whistles to keep us separated and maintain their power and control. It harms especially people of color, and that cannot be overstated. But it also doesn't serve any of us except for very few at the top. McGee writes, racism works against non-wealthy white Americans. It lowers their support for government actions that could help them economically out of a zero-sum fear that it could help the racialized undeserving as well. She draws a through line showing how this zero-sum thinking has collapsed unions that could advocate for all workers and powered disinvestment of public services like higher education. When more students of color began attending college, she writes, public funding dried up. College students of color 40 years ago were just 1 in 6. Now they're near to half. Parallel to that rise in students of color came cuts to per student funding. In the past 30 years, public college tuition has almost tripled. She posits that it's why states like Texas refuse Medicare expansion, refusing what's basically for them free federal funding. That would mean all rural Texans have better access to hospitals. The refusal is fear that expanding public health care would draw and serve more people of color too. Black people suffer the most from racism, but our whole human family is harmed. Solidarity, she says, is the answer. Solidarity. She quotes a longtime activist she interviewed in her research, quote, "If we didn't have these sharp divisions based on race, we could make enormous progress in terms of making sure that people are not hurting as badly as they are or deprived of what clearly are the necessities of life." And McGee continues, "Over the years that I have sought answers to why a fair economy is elusive, it has become clearer to me that how white people understand what's right and wrong about our diverse nation, who belongs and who deserves, is determining our collective course," she writes. This is the crux of it. Can we swim together in the same pool or not? It's a political question, yes, and one with economic ramifications, but at its core, she writes, it's a moral question. And it's a question for us as people of faith. I no longer believe that we can advance justice in the United States in a meaningful way without dealing with the history of enslavement and its inherited racism, not in fighting climate change or fighting hunger. Racism cannot be separated from the rest of our social justice commitments because it is part and parcel of it. And that means that we must build connections and solidarity across race in Greater Boston. In our segregated world, that work can seem daunting, but as people of faith, let us not be daunted. We are simply called to begin. We are called to do what we can in as many ways as we can for as long as we can. After 10 years at the Urban Ministry, I still bring to your pulpit no more expertise than when I began. But what I have is a conviction that building relationships across race is foundational for all justice work. And I come to the same strategies as the year I arrived, to build real connections. Those of us who are white need to listen and learn and follow. At the Urban Ministry, we listen to the community to guide us forward. In partnership with the Roxbury Historical Society, we began research into the history of enslavement by the Congregation of First Church Roxbury, whose church and campus we inherited and now inhabit. We published a report citing the names of 58 enslaved persons owned by First Church Roxbury congregants, with even the first minister being an enslaver. And we asked Roxbury community members to guide us forward from there. For the past year, neighbors have charted our course, seeking to learn more about the lives of those named in the report, and trying to track their genealogy to find descendants who might be living in Roxbury today. It might seem that the urgency would be confronting the racial injustices happening right now, and yes, that is important, but the Black community says this also matters. Historic truth-telling, making the past visible, and deeply honoring the lives of those who are dishonored by our religious ancestors. This matters urgently too. and we learn. For the past 5 years, we've held a series of webinar lectures called Community Conversations, in which we invite in African American leaders to talk about the challenges facing the Black community in Boston. They've spoken on gentrification and displacement, educational inequity, the racial wealth gap. We learn for an ever-deepening understanding of past and present. We've built a tours program that is led by local community members that highlights the history of the Roxbury neighborhood that we stand in. These tours tell the story of public art in Nubian Square, how the glorious public murals grew out of the work of graffiti artists that were targeted by the city, or about the trees in Roxbury and how important and threatened the urban tree canopy is. Students of color in our after-school program design their own tours of our neighborhood, highlighting what matters most to them about their community. And they share these tours and stories with visiting Unitarian Universalist youth from around the country. Maybe Tulsa can come one day. Young people share history and hope with other young people. And we follow. Our work in partnership has deepened. When the NAACP asked us to fill a bus to go to Washington, D.C., Unitarian Universalists filled the bus and went to Washington, D.C. As the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute addresses violence in the city, we stand behind them, inviting congregations to join the Mother's Day Walk for Peace in Dorchester. When the housing advocacy group City Life asks us to stuff envelopes for a mailing, we stuff envelopes. We build solidarity by showing up again and again in the spirit of listening and learning. When you enter the doors of the urban ministry, you'll see on the wall a quote by the Aboriginal activist Lila Watson. It says, "If you are here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together." These words resonate as a spiritual truth. But there's a very concrete truth there too, that the sum of us reminds us, the truth that until we grapple with the history of enslavement and racism and bridge our divide and commit to working in solidarity, we will not be free, not any of us, of all that ails us. We need to work together. On my long last hike in the Canadian Rockies, we climbed up Larch Valley to Sentinel Pass, steadily making a 2,500-foot elevation gain to a stunning view, and then we began our descent. And as we descended, we came upon startled hikers warning that a grizzly bear was along the trail ahead. She was in a state of what is called hyperphagia, a trance-like focus on eating enough calories for winter. Our hike leaders reminded us of what is called for when faced with grave danger. Make noise, people, and stick together. And so we held close and began singing until we were safely through and the trail ended. That's what will get us through the hard and dangerous days ahead, friends. Let us sing loudly, reach out to the whole human family, and stick together. And amen. The Indigo Girls have a line in one of their songs that says, "If you have a care in the world, you have a gift to bring. Whatever is troubling you calls you forward, and you are enough. Go forth knowing that, and go forth in courage and faith. Amen." The service begins when the service ends.
Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go.
please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.